The method.
Ideas. Method became
unsound.
Are my methods unsound?
Without doubt. Do you call it unsound method?
I don't see any method at all.
Hello and welcome to Unsound Methods with me, Jamie Batchin.
And me, Lachlan Bloom. For those of you listening to the podcast for the first time, this is part of a series where we talk to fellow writers about their process and technique.
So this is the September 2021 episode of Unsound Methods, and our guest today is Rebecca Watson, who is the author of Little Scratch. Rebecca joined us sometime in the summer. I can't remember exactly when. I think it was before the 1 week of hot weather that we had this summer.
I've been up in Scotland and it was actually quite sunny up there. So had a few weeks of sunshine.
So maybe the weather, the weather was okay down here. I'm not going to get all jealous and nationalistic and try to argue that English weather was outdoing Scottish weather at any point.
It's normally not an argument you'd get involved in Scotland.
Yeah, I see the weather forecast most nights, you know. I see you. So Rebecca joined us to talk about her novel, Little Scratch. And it's a novel that's provoked some discussion. Some of the articles that people would have seen with Rebecca herself talking about experimental fiction and the frankly unfair way in which the term experimental there is often used in a sort of pejorative sense, or as a way of warning people off the book to say, oh, this is difficult. This might not be for you.
Yeah. And I think it was interesting speaking to Rebecca about what she was trying to do with this novel, her sort of efforts to capture the immediacy of thought and translate that onto the page, which I think is something that experimental fiction, if you choose that term, it's uniquely equipped to do. So it was interesting to understand her process to make that translation.
Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the things that we discussed with her was what term she would use and what term we're comfortable with using. But anyway, that chat is coming up. Thanks for listening. Here's Rebecca Watson. I thought one of the things that was interesting to kick our discussion off today was that Little Scratch, your debut novel, is something that you developed from a short story. And that I thought would be an interesting thing to just investigate how you went about that process, how you started the short story and then how you decided to expand it.
I guess so. Yeah, the first thing of the book was a short story. And actually, the first thing of the book was just writing a quick passage. And I think what I didn't have was a sense of the kind of massive ambition of the project. I didn't know whether I was writing a short story or a book. I just knew that I had a voice I wanted to write and a moment I wanted to write. And so what happened was that I wrote something quite short, only a few hundred words. And even though I don't usually write short stories, I think I saw the White Review Short Story Prize. And so I was like, kind of set myself the task of developing this small passage into a long enough story for the prize. And so it kind of became a short story purely because of that. And what I discovered once I finished writing it and once I'd submitted it was that I just really wasn't done with it. And I really had a sense that this kind of, you know, that kind of itching feeling when often when you finish writing something, there's a kind of resolution, there's a feeling of completion. I didn't have that at all, and I really had her voice still quite loudly in my head. So I went back to it, and the way I tested it, I guess, because even then I didn't know it was going to be like a book, maybe it'd be a longer story, I don't know. So I just kind of started pushing at the edges of the story. So I would kind of write a bit earlier on in time and a bit later afterwards as well. And what I discovered quite quickly in that process was that there was just like, there was loads to it, and there was loads of kind of urges that I had of that voice and what I wanted to write. And I was also not writing chronologically. So because I was suddenly writing like the morning scene or like an evening scene, I clearly had this kind of unit of time of day in my head. And so it kind of unveiled itself to me that it was obviously going to become a book. But yeah, I do think it's quite a hard thing when you're first writing to know like what form something's going to take. It's, you know, how much commitment you're really making into a project.
The form of it being set over, I don't know if it's strictly 24 hours, but from a day from morning to evening, that just came about from where the voice was leading you, essentially, as you expanded the story. That wasn't pre-planned?
Well, I mean, it kind of was both planned and not. I mean, you know, so initially the short story was a lunch break, right? I knew that I wanted to write some of the day, basically, because I was getting these instincts of, you know, writing earlier and later and whatever. And then, you know, the way in which I kind of trained that into a kind of more sense of like a plan was to be like, okay, set yourself the task of writing a day. And so the unit of time changed, and that was more of an active process. That was me saying, okay, this unit of time makes sense to use, you know. From deciding to do that, it very quickly was just like the obvious thing to do. I was kind of amazed that wasn't kind of the thing I was thinking of from the get-go, because it obviously worked. I think sometimes when you start projects, it's almost like not wanting to be over ambitious or presumptuous about the kind of how big a size this writing task is going to be. And so I sometimes start with kind of writing exercises, and it's only in the writing that I kind of can trust that what I'm doing is kind of beyond just kind of one little thing.
Did you find that the voice it was quite easy to stick with that one voice? Were you sort of adding more sort of sections, and then sort of looking back and going, actually that's good, but it doesn't fit with what I'm doing with this voice, and rejecting stuff or having to go over a section that you'd written to get it into the same voice?
I think the voice was the kind of one reliable thing that I had. I mean, she is like an incredibly performative, neurotic, loud voice. So when I was writing it was kind of just like the only way I really could come out was was via that. And so I think that the more the things I had to be kind of really thinking about was like what I wanted her to be doing and thinking about, and making sure that she was kind of exploring the right things. And there was definitely some stuff where I would start writing in one direction and then be like, this isn't actually like helpful for the book in itself. Yes, you might think this, but it's not going to contribute to the book, and that would go. But the voice itself was loud. I think the voice was kind of very set, because her voice in a way is basically just the sound of thought when it's fixed. You know, like, you're not meant to read the way someone thinks, you're meant to forget it. And it's kind of like in having that set down, you suddenly have this kind of circling neurosis. And so, yeah, she was kind of just like, yeah, impossible to escape, I would say.
Did you find you had to scale it back at all? Did it sort of become too caricatured at all? Or was that something you had to contend with?
I think that like the comedy a bit was very important as a way of curtailing like too much neurosis, but because she has like, yeah, that kind of full on voice, I think that's why I really leaned towards comedy. That was a kind of stabilizing force, because it undid any of the kind of leaning towards caricature. It made sure that she was always, I guess, self-conscious of herself, how she was thinking, what she was doing. And so there was always a kind of a tripping up of anything that might go too far.
And with the formal structuring, and I'm sure this is something that you are answering lots of questions on surrounding this book, at what point did you decide how to break the page up and how it would appear on the page? Were you doing that as you were filling in a Word document or a Google Doc, whatever you were using? Were you doing that from the start?
Yeah, so it's probably best just to explain how it started. Yeah,
probably for the listeners as well, maybe just to give a slight overview of.
Yeah, sure. So the form was like the first thing that actually happened. Well, but the form and the voice to me are kind of inextricable. I think the form is the character, and it's her mind. But the form and the whole book, everything came from quite a simple moment, which was like I was in the office, and I always have to kind of disclaim this, the book is fiction, but the kernel of the novel came from a very mundane but real moment, which was me in my lunch break sitting with a notebook and a colleague walking past me and asking what book I'd read recently, and me being unable to answer the question for about 15 seconds and not being able to remember any book I'd ever read or whether I could read or whether books existed. And then obviously I scrabbled and remembered the name of something I'd read, and it was completely fine, and it answered the question, he went. But after he'd gone, it really got me thinking about the kind of the claustrophobia or insanity of immediacy present, like immediate present tense, the way that those 15 seconds could feel so high stakes, make me feel like I'm actually insane, when all it is just, you know, trying to get my brain working. And so I really wanted to, like, you know, when he'd left and I was writing my lunch breaks anyway, that was kind of a way in which I was finding time to write. I kind of just set myself that as a writing exercise. I was like, how the fuck could you get that on the page to, like, explain how it feels and to, like, make the reader inhabit time the same way that I was in that moment, not relying on them waiting to the end of the paragraph, to the end of the sentence, to get the sense of the many different things happening at the same time. And so that question or that exercise that I set myself was kind of, it was such a pressure point. It was such a kind of impossible thing to me at that moment to display that in a way it kind of just happened. Like I do write, I have always written kind of formally, strangely, to use a very clunky phrase. So, you know, I was never, my instinct is never towards kind of very linear prose. And so it wasn't like I went from writing kind of straight prose to suddenly something very strange. But I just had this real, like, you know, clicking light bulb moment where it was like the page to me was, you know, would be the mind, and as you pass down the page, you pass through time. And so once I had that revelation, there was a kind of system that appeared on the page to make it sound very kind of magical and slightly cliched. But yeah, it just seemed very clear to me there was a system, and there was a kind of spine to the page. And so then that moment when I was writing, just this moment of her being asked that question, that was a way that I kind of really just set down my first ideas of how the form would work. And how I kind of found her voice was, as I was saying earlier, the kind of the fixing of thoughts becomes a kind of neurotic, loud voice by necessity. And then after that, like, I mean, I wrote by hand, which is how the form was so easy to do. If I was writing in a Word document, it would be impossible because it'd be so slow. It does take a while. And then basically my way of editing, my way of fixing what I'd written by hand was to then translate it into a Word document. And so that slow process became something that was helpful rather than obstructing.
Is that slower just in terms of your typing speed compared with your handwriting speed?
Just because, I mean, I'm actually like I'm a quick typer, but I'm writing across the page, so I'm going between the different columns, the different fragments on a page. And so to get something on the right point of the page and be able to quickly go between the two different things would instantly be, like, really difficult. And so just kind of, you know, shifting between the different parts of the page would slow me down. And particularly when you're trying to write and you're trying to retain the different threads across the page that you want to have overlapping, I think I would kind of, as I was writing, I would forget some of it as I was going.
Yeah, well, I guess it was important to get that sort of the immediacy, to get it immediately down on the page as well. It's capturing the idea of immediacy in thought and that 15-second gap, but also you need to do that quickly to get it on the page.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that so much of that book, that novel, needed speed. The way I wrote it was very quick, and I think that the kind of live rhythm in the novel comes from a very quick writing process. Yeah,
it's quite like the idea of that immediacy, the thought. I think it's especially at the moment, there's a lot of, it feels like there are changes in the way that people, that your colleague asking you the question, it's a perfectly normal social situation, but it's changed by the fact that, you know, people have been locked up for a year and a half, and the way we sort of mediate conversations is a lot more commonly through text messages, WhatsApps, emails and stuff. That takes up so much of the space of communication now compared with what used to be face-to-face conversation. I think that immediacy, it's I mean, it changes all the time, but capturing that is something that's evolving.
Yeah, and I think that Little Scratch, like, taps into some of that in the kind of I don't know, like, I think I don't think it's like a millennial novel, but it does tap into perhaps like a psyche that maybe younger people will be familiar with already. Like, I think that thought patterns and, yeah, the way that we think, the kind of the way in which we manage to, like, move around the world, have conversations, etc., when there's so much going on that we're constantly processing and balancing, all of that stuff relies on you not thinking about the fact that you're doing that. But the kind of technological world of like texting, emailing, like scrolling through things, all of these things kind of bring that process into a kind of more conscious light. And so you can kind of apply a lot of that world into the kind of real physical world. And so I found that really interesting when I was writing of thinking about that kind of more conscious bombardment, overwhelmment, simultaneity, and how that kind of ties into the way that we've always have existed. And, you know, it's not new to live in a kind of bombarding, overwhelming world, overlapping world. Like that is just existence. But yeah, how can technology in some ways like draw that into kind of closer attention?
Yeah. And I mean, I guess, you know, if your colleague had sent you a WhatsApp saying, what book have you read? You would have had that distance and the time to sort of consider it, or, you know, look back at you wouldn't feel I've got to answer within the next 15 seconds. You might not reply for an hour or two until you had the answer that you're happy with.
Yeah, and I think that's why, like, that's what the book's trying to address instead of that kind of thought experience, that, you know, thinking over things, whatever. Like, it's like the reader themselves has to inhabit this head that you can't get out of and that you're living within for a day nonstop. And so it's like looking at the kind of experience where you can't kind of check out or pause. You have to just like keep going.
But there's also the other conversation that carries on throughout the book with the protagonist's partner as well, which is happening via a messaging service, when you can see whether someone has seen what you've sent them and not responded and things like that, and kind of mediating how you feel about that. And so it sort of investigates the immediacy and those really protracted conversations there.
Yeah, and how those kind of conversations feel so kind of jarring, so different to like actual ways of talking, and yet feed into that kind of, I don't know, I find that kind of stuff very interesting of, you know, obviously the character being in a completely different office and doing something completely different to her boyfriend, not being able to imagine where he is or how he is existing, and yet having this strange connection to him where they send each other like an emoji or like three words, and that in some way just keeps you going or keeps some kind of connection to each other going. It's kind of like fascinating that's just a way that we communicate.
You said you wrote it quite quickly. So from going from the short story to having the novel as a first draft, so what was the kind of time frame on that?
People always hate me when I give answers this question. I hate myself because my second novel is not at all comparable to the first novel writing experience. But so it was a calendar year. So I started writing the short story in January 2018, and I finished the novel in, well, November, and then sat on it until after Christmas. So it was a 2018 one draft, 1 year wonder.
Right.
Yeah.
Prior to writing the short story, what sort of other stuff were you writing? Was it other short stories, or just sort of you said it was a few hundred word sort of snippet that you started with? Do you tend to sort of just put a few hundred words down and sit on it and see if it has legs to go further, or do you sort of embark on, right, I'm going to write a 3,000 word short story?
My instinct is definitely not short stories. It's kind of random because now it's kind of set in stone that Little Scratch started as a short story, and that makes me seem like a short story writer. But I really see that short story as basically just like a kind of passage of the book that fortunately was kind of complete enough or seemed complete enough in itself to like convince people that it was a short story. Before Little Scratch, I was writing all sorts. I mean, you know, if we're to go back to my first experiences of writing, I was writing poetry, but a very kind of prose poetry that I think in some way resembles a lot of what I'm writing now, but I just didn't really know what to call it. I think I started small in kind of small units, rather than being like, oh, I'm going to write a novel, just because like I didn't really know whether I was a writer or not. I think that it takes quite a lot to convince yourself you are a writer. And so having kind of smaller ambitions, it's, you know, smaller structures is in some way a kind of quieter or casualer way of writing. But before Little Scratch, I actually wrote kind of vignette-based, I guess, creative nonfiction book, which had like a kind of fictionalized thread. And then it also like used memories from my life and stuff, which I thought was quite good, but was kind of didn't really have a set genre or general ambition. I don't know. It was kind of a way of me like flexing my muscles. And I really see the thing I wrote before Little Scratch as a way of just kind of practicing. And actually what I would do is I would have like a memory. I'd remember something from my life and I would write it down so that whenever I remembered something, if it was kind of like more than 5 years ago, I would write it down for a week. And then I would just set myself each memory to try and write it in a kind of dramatized or interesting fashion. How would I set myself that task as if it wasn't my life? And that was just me practicing writing, basically. That was me kind of, yeah, just kind of, it was just like my own writing exercises.
You say you did it for a week. Would you sort of rewrite it in different styles, or that was just sort of expanding on that one memory in one piece?
It was just kind of expanding, yeah. And they were formally quite weird, and I think I was trying to like, I was practicing voice really, and playing with form. And what I found as I was kind of starting to write these things was that they all kind of contributed to one central idea of like the idea of, you know, becoming a woman and the way in which we kind of work out who we are and stuff like that. And so there was kind of one main conceit to what I was doing. So then it seemed like a project. And then that's when I kind of started writing and using these passages to make something bigger. But then when I was finished with it, it felt like something that was done, but it didn't feel like something that was necessarily to be published. It kind of just felt like something that was, I had kind of played around with form, and I'd also kind of had practice with how to structure things, so it all just felt like a kind of drafting training ground.
And in terms of the memories, did you sort of actively have to, like, consciously sort of, when a memory came to you, note it down, or was it quite?
Yeah, that's what I did. I literally had I had an iPhone then, so my iPhone notes were just full of, it would be like one sentence, and then later I'd like go through my notes and be like, okay, what have I written down? And then I would just be like, okay, I'm writing that today. Yeah. And you know, I was working full time then, so it was a really easy way of, in my lunch break, I would like go to a cafe and then I'd be like, okay, let's have a look at what's going on here in my notes. Okay, I'm going to use that, write that now. You've got an hour, go.
Did you use that same approach in Little Scratch to, you know, making a one line note to yourself and then coming back to write that, even though it wasn't your personal memory?
A bit. I would send myself emails, but generally with Little Scratch, I found it really easy to get into her voice. And so I would, in a lunch break, I would just go and I would write for an hour, and that would be some of Little Scratch. It was kind of just like, I guess, because I had the kind of plot of the day, because the plot was kind of like her head plus like environment, so I knew that where she was throughout the day, and so I could very easily be like, okay, I feel today like I'm in the mood for writing a morning scene, or oh, I think I'm gonna take her on a trip in the afternoon to the corner shop. And so it was quite easy for me just to be like, okay, do this. And then, you know, later would just kind of go through my notebook, because as I was saying, I wrote by hand, so I would just like go through my notebook and see what I'd done.
And how did it make it from your notebook then into where you I assume you didn't just continually edit freehand written notes?
No, and it was definitely not the kind of neatest looking notebook in the world. But yeah, so every kind of few thousand words I would type it up, and then that allowed me to kind of see what I'd done and how it was looking, and to kind of edit as it became a Word doc. And because I wasn't writing chronologically as well, it was the kind of organizing bit, because it's where I'd kind of work out where things belonged as well. And so it kind of went from this very kind of messy book where order was irrelevant to a kind of very ordered Word document, where as soon as something was written, that to me felt like the line was ready and it was in the right position and everything like that. So they're kind of these two different spaces, and that meant that I was allowed to have a kind of messy, free-flowing writing place, but then I also had some sense of order, some sense of control, planning when it came onto my laptop.
This is very technical, but this is only because of how I've written in the past, I'm interested in this. Was it one continuous Word document that you would slot bits in and out of, or did you have a series of Word documents for different parts of the day that you then put together later on?
Yeah, interesting. I kind of struggle to remember this entirely, but I think the answer is that I had this one main doc that was the day. sometimes if I was writing stuff up and I wasn't entirely decided where it would go, then it would go in a second document, which is kind of just like stuff that's yet to be fixed, basically. And so I'd go between those two things, but generally everything would go in the one document, the one day.
And you were then editing in that main document?
Yes, but the editing was like, it was very much in the writing up. So as it came into the document,
so you'd be looking at a page of notes in your notebook and then spending time on a single page in the Word doc.
In the notebook, it wasn't really notes. It was essentially, I mean, I think the difference between the Word doc and the notebook wasn't that different, but it was the kind of honing as it was being typed up. And so, you know, words would change or I would kind of change my mind about where something exactly sat. But yeah, it was, you know, it wasn't a too dramatic transition between the two different spaces. It was more like remembering what I'd written, reaffirming whether I agreed with how the decision that I'd made, the phrases that I'd used before it could really be fixed.
And then once you had the final, well, like a first draft of the whole document, did you change much at that point? That was the novel.
Yeah, I'm sure I went through it several times, and you know, and it, obviously you don't really know how it reads until you have the whole thing that you can read through. And I'm sure I was then going through and editing that and kind of adjusting things. Yeah, definitely. But there wasn't like a kind of...
You didn't have draft 920.
No, it was like a kind of one draft, but there was that draft in itself had, you know, casual tweakings and movement and stuff like that. Yeah.
I feel like that should be more upsetting for other writers to hear than the fact that it took you a year to do it.
I know. but it's fine. Like, people can't hate me because I'm now spending time on a second novel where, like, I remember the process of the first novel and I'm like, how do I get that and how did I do it? And I think some of those projects, I think because of the speed of the book, the quickness of the voice, everything, it needed to be a really quick writing process. And it was a very kind of like spark, you know, like really like a live thing to write. And because, yeah, she was kind of so loud and performative, it needed to be like that. I kind of can't imagine I'll ever really have a project that works like that again, but it was just a necessity of the voice.
Do you think it'll, I mean, it sounds like you wrote it mainly sort of in snatched moments, like in lunch breaks and in longhand in a notebook when you could, rather than sort of blocking out time and sitting at a desk.
I kind of did both, to be honest. I mean, the thing about, yes, you know, yes, I wrote in a year, but I was also writing all the time. Like, yes, I was working, I guess I worked across two different jobs in the process of writing this, both kind of assistant jobs, both full time. And so I would write every day. I would write in my lunch break every day. I would write in free evenings after work. I would write for a few hours minimum every weekend. And so I was writing all the time, but I was also not prioritizing. I didn't have a sense of like more valuable time, like any time was productive and helpful. So it was kind of making sure that I didn't just say, oh, okay, well, I'll give myself this time of the weekend. It was like, well, you have this lunch break, so use it. The reason it then became so quick was not because I was just writing every day, but because in writing every day, you're so in the project, you're so aware of exactly where you're at. There's no way of like losing the voice or losing the vision because you're just constantly working.
I gotta get out of here. I think I'm gonna lose it.
Uh-oh. Sounds like somebody's got a case of the Mondays.
Let me ask you something. When you come in on Monday and you're not feeling real well, does anyone ever say to you, sounds like someone has a case of the Mondays?
No. No, man.
You know how important I consider this report to be. I come in and I discover that this is the fruit of your labors.
You don't go this through my stuff and I'm not in it.
How important do you think it is for your process to be in different locations writing? I mean, presumably your lunch break, you're writing somewhere different than you were at the weekend, and you know you've got the notebook with you always, but you're not in the same physical location. I mean, is that something going forward you would continue to do, or given the choice, would you rather just have the full-time hours to sit in front at a desk and write in one place?
I don't know how much difference it makes. I mean, like, so now I'm part-time nowadays. So I am an editor for 3 days a week and then 2 days a week writing. And so I do have, I do everything at home from the same table, God forbid.
Do you sort of long to get out and sit in a cafe for an hour to write?
I don't think I do. I think I was writing different places just because that's where I was. And like, you know, I think it was a good... It was a good thing to do, and the fact that it kind of showed me that, like, you can't really be fussy or pretentious about writing spaces, or, you know, be too sacred about it. Just do it wherever you can. And it kind of showed me that writing isn't a kind of a precious process. It's a process that you just commit to, and you do it when you can, where you can, whatever. Now, you know, I have the kind of opposite world where I have and have had for a while since the book was bought. You know, I have 2 days a week where I can just have this kind of luxurious space where I'm completely in control of it, and I have loads of time. And actually, in some ways, like, I find that a bit harder because it's more kind of pressurized time. It's set time. It's when I'm like writer, you know, like in kind of capital letters, and there's this kind of stamp to it. And actually, in some ways, there was a kind of inhibition. There was a freedom to the way that I wrote then, because it was kind of just like the project felt vital enough that any time was writing time.
Do you find that balanced and difficult? If we say this might not be an arrangement, but for the sake of argument, that Thursday and Friday are writing days, and if you're very preoccupied with something in the middle of Tuesday, and you're sort of itching to fill your lunch break with writing, are you sort of happy to do that, or did you just keep it for the 2 days when you've got the time, all the time to dedicate to it?
For a while, I was just using those 2 days. You've guessed correctly, Thursday and Friday. And so, yeah, I was just using those 2 days. But what I discovered was basically that, yeah, I needed to be in the project more. And every Thursday morning, I was just like kind of clearing my head, throat clearing, doing all of that kind of stuff to get back into it. And so then particularly when I started working from home, I do an hour in the morning, every morning, and that's enough to keep me involved. I think I'm actually now on a break because I finished my second draft, and so I'm giving myself a month not looking at it, because I think it's very hard to get distance, particularly when you are looking at it every single day, even if for a little bit. And so now, yeah, I'm not writing at all, and I think I may start trying to write like some stuff that's nothing to do with the current project, but I'm kind of trying to restrict myself as much as possible.
And in that month, is anyone else looking at it, or are you just, it's cooking away in the drawer, as it were?
Yeah, two people are looking at it, my boyfriend and my friend, who are both gonna give me some feedback.
Is that the first time that anyone else has seen it?
No, one or two people have seen it in a previous iteration, in a previous very, very messy, hideous iteration that I now kind of feel very embarrassed to have shared. But I think it's also really important too. And I think, you know, you need fresh eyes sometimes, or even like, I think sometimes it's before they've even like looked at it, but in knowing that they're looking at it, you somehow see it slightly differently. There's a kind of, I don't know, it slightly refreshes or resets things and allows you to have a slightly different eye on it. So I think it's very good to do that. I think, yeah, having the things that I feel like I've learned from writing is basically, when you're writing, be as immersed as possible, be as connected to the project as possible. And, you know, yes, like, I don't have kids and I have 2 days a week where I can write. I have lots of reasons why I can be as involved. But even 15 minutes a day is vital. I think it does so much. So that kind of level of commitment to the project, I feel like, is the thing that I really know I need to do. And from having stopped doing that for a bit, I know that it makes a massive difference. And then, like, distance as well. So the pause where you don't allow yourself to look at it in any way. Like, I'm not going to open that document. I'm not going to even like reread a few things, nothing. I'm not going to think about it, or at least try not to think about it. That distance, again, just gives you such a refresh and allows you to kind of get back into redrafting in a far more helpful way.
Mm. And have you got that date marked down on the calendar? You know exactly when it is that you're going to...
I do, yeah.
That's got to be motivating as well, for, as you say, the distance, for giving yourself the headspace away from it.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I feel like my, like, I don't know, like my lover's gone over gone away on some boat, and like I've got this date where I know that he's like back again. It's gonna be great. Like I'm looking forward to it. And maybe I'll be like, when he returns, I'll be like, God, you're actually really annoying, and I never noticed the way that you like laugh before, whatever. But at least that distance has allowed me to see that, you know.
Yeah, indeed.
Do you find it easy to disconnect from it? I mean, are you in this month, have you found yourself to think, oh, I should have done that before I send it to them, or when I get it back, I'm gonna change this.
Yeah, I have found it quite easy actually, but that's only because I only really send it at a point where when I feel like I need to stop looking at it. It's the kind of frustration point where whether it's ready or not is slightly different, but it's kind of just like for the moment I'm done. And yes, like within that time you start thinking about, you just kind of start, I guess, being a bit mean to yourself about things or being like, oh, that's crap or something, they're not like that bit or whatever. But I think like in terms of kind of like my more, you know, itchy writing tweaks and stuff like that, I don't have that at all. I'm like, okay, I'm definitely done. I need time off.
With your notes, I guess this goes back to Little Scratch, actually, and I don't know about the any sort of formal innovation that you're using in the new one, but you, when you were writing it freehand, I assume it was an A4 notepad.
Just because of the way that, you're assuming correctly.
Okay. Well, it could have gone for A3. With the paperback version, it's in that wider format. I don't know what the industry calls that. Is that just because the text needs that space to fit on the page?
Yeah, we basically had to find the appropriate format for the book. I wrote in quite wide notepads. I don't know what the exact size is, but they're pretty wide. And I think that, I mean, I don't know, like I would have probably just ended up writing smaller if I had a smaller notebook, because I did need that width of the page. And yeah, and so when it went into typesetting, it was basically just finding a format where, and even then I had to edit some of the stuff to make it fit. But yeah, the width needed to stay. And, you know, that's partly because obviously the form, because I, as I was saying, like you go through time as you pass down the page. So there is a certain amount that needs to be kept width-wise that it wouldn't make sense for something to shift lines just to go to the next line. And so we really had to work out, yeah, like what we could use, and also, but whilst it not looking unbearable. So it was a bit of a discussion. That was kind of one of the first things we were really talking about, me and my editor, and looking at books and like seeing what might work. And I remember the time it being a really like dramatic thing of being like, oh God, is it gonna be too wide? It's gonna be like embarrassingly wide. It's like, it's fine. I think it looks great.
There's that children's book format, isn't there? That's kind of A4 landscape almost.
Yeah.
That could have upset the publisher.
Yeah, your publisher has not given you a stack of industry standard notebooks for the next project. Just use these next time.
I haven't seen the ebook version. How does it work for that? Because that must be a bit of a nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, I've got 2 1-star reviews on Amazon, which are both bizarrely in German, where they just complain that the ebook doesn't work. So I'm not sure what that's about. But I mean, it's basically like it's fixed. It's like a PDF. So you it doesn't reformat. So unless you've got like an iPad or a decent sized e-reader or very large eyes, probably not having a great time.
Just encourage people to buy the paperback from
that wasn't a great advert for the ebook, was it? And actually I saw someone the other day, I met a reader the other day who'd read it on ebook, and they're really into it. So it's obviously people don't mind it. But I think also if you've heard about the book but you don't know about the form, so obviously like not all of my readership are kind of literary fiction people or people that are into kind of experimental writing. So I think some people, like, if you have the affront of it on an ebook, you don't even know whether it's right or not. And so I think some people were like, they'd open the first page and be like, oh, the formatting's messed up. Better return it. Whereas if it's, you know, print in the book, you at least know that it's meant to look like that.
I think, was it maybe Nicola Barker's Happy? There was a book I was looking at on, I read on a Kobo if I'm reading ebooks, and it said at the top of the page, basically, go buy the book, because like even the publisher had even put like there's certain differences in color on the text.
Yes, really, yeah.
So yeah, don't read this on a black and white Kindle, because it's not, or Kobo, it's not gonna work.
You wonder why they even sell it if it's so actively, yeah.
Well, that's kind of good, because that keeps a lot of the people doing really innovative things with their like book design going as well. So I'm all
yeah, definitely
encouraging people to go with the book.
Yeah.
With the something I wanted to ask you about, with the how you describe yourself as a writer and the fiction you do, and problems that we have on this podcast with the term experimental, and how have you, how do you describe your writing? What have you reconciled yourself with?
I feel like I can bitch about the term, but I also don't really mind it that much. I think it's sad that the usually experimental is used negatively. It's a kind of like a warning flag, and I just think that's a bit sad. I think that my writing is like, I guess, formally innovative. I don't know. I mean, you know, everyone's doing a fucking experiment. Like that's just kind of what writing is. It's just like, you know, seeing what works, seeing what sticks, and you know, it stops being an experiment when it's a success, when you know that it works, when you're pleased with it. And so, yeah, I don't know. I kind of feel caged by the way in which other people use terms. But I mean, I just think I'm a novelist, to be honest. And I think that I'm a novelist with an interest in form, and who kind of sees structure as integral as any other part of writing. I think actually, like, the decision to write in linear prose is a decision as well. Although obviously it seems the kind of set thing, but also like I'm not writing this way as a kind of diversion or a decision. It's the instinct. I think trying to write a book in linear prose would be more of an experiment for me, or more of a decision to make. It would be actually I'm going to divert and try this instead. And so I think that, yeah, we're very picky about our terms, and I think actually often the terms just kind of interrupt or obstruct people. And actually, like, when I've had readers discover Little Scratch who didn't know about the form and have had decided to read it anyway, they've all been surprised. I've had so many reactions where people have been like, oh, actually, like, this is really accessible, or oh, the way in which people have spoken to me before about experimental writing or form has been completely different to my experience of reading this book. And so I just think, yeah, like, just call me a novelist, just call this book a novel, and then like, see how the readers go with it.
And do you feel that that sort of instinct towards formal innovation, is that something you feel is wrapped up? I mean, it's obviously part and parcel with the novel in terms of Little Scratch, the form, it has to be that form to be that novel. But is that something that it comes with the project, or is that something to do with the way that you as a writer relate to an empty page? Like, could you imagine yourself writing a sort of linear prose novel, or is it just something that is intrinsic to you as a writer rather than intrinsic to the project?
Yeah, I think it is kind of intrinsic to me. Yeah, I mean, my instinct has always been a kind of half prose, at least, partly because I think I write in first person generally, and I'm very interested in the way that we actually think or perceive things or whatever. And all of these things don't really work in linear, neat prose. That doesn't feel particularly accurate to what I'm trying to pin down, particularly because the first person I'm interested in is a very kind of speech or performance led writing. And actually, once you start listening to the way people speak, it's really not very satisfying or very pretty sentences. And so, yeah, the instinct just isn't prose and ever has been. Although at the same time, if you hear Little Scratch out loud, I did the audiobook, if you listen to that, I don't think you'd know how it looked on the page at all. And so it's kind of just like, although form is the instinct, and it's definitely a kind of like a visual instinct, and the way that I see the page is definitely a slightly different way to how I might if I was a kind of prose stylist. I do think that like we kind of maybe stress the form too much, and that it does still rely on more traditional sounding sentences than you might expect.
Having done the audiobook is really interesting, actually, because there are certain parts where, and I found this with other writers who've used columns, sometimes you'll feel like the information, for me, just as one unique reader, is easier to digest maybe if you follow the line downwards and then go across and see what the sort of counterpoint was. But I guess if we hear you reading the audiobook, I have a definite idea about exactly how in your mind the flow of the writing is.
Yeah, I was kind of initially maybe like a little bit cautious about the audiobook, because some of the task of the book is for the reader to make decisions and for the reader to inhabit the head of this character, and in hearing it, the decisions are made for you and you're hearing it in someone else's voice and it's kind of presented for you. I think there are other things to gain from the audiobook, though. I feel like there are actually just slightly different things. I don't think it's a kind of a clear, straight representation of the book. But I don't know. I've had readers who have both read the book and listened to it, and that in a way is actually like informed their understanding of each iterations, which I find interesting. But I also think that, like, even though you are making decisions when you're reading the book, I do suspect that most readers make the same decisions, and that some of it is actually a kind of deceit where you're made to think you're more in control than you actually are. I do think I am leading people in the direction that they think they're walking in.
We don't have free will. We only have the illusion of free will. Oh, we're so manipulated.
And speaking of audio, do you read out what you've written at all at any stage in the writing, editing process? Is that part of your process to sort of read back?
Parts of it. I also generally, like, when I'm writing, I'm saying it in my head. So it is very much like an internally vocal thing. So that is part of it. And then when I'm rereading it, there's always a kind of very conscious voice to it. Sometimes I am literally just reading it out loud, although I don't as much now just because my boyfriend works from home and it would perhaps be like a little bit annoying if he just had this woman at the table like reading random snippets of things out all the time.
But that's at the sort of writing stage you'd be reading it rather than you've got a draft. And
sometimes when I have this little scratch, sometimes if I was not in the office or in a cafe and I was writing, I'd be saying what I was writing as I was writing sometimes. But I think more often the reading in my head or reading out loud happens in the kind of editing process when I'm going back over things and you're kind of checking the rhythm, checking how it sounds, how it feels, the kind of tones of the words and stuff like that. That's when hearing it is the most helpful thing.
When you're writing it, that sort of speaking in your head voice, do you feel that's akin to the sort of 15-second gap when your colleague asked you, and your brain sort of scrambling around trying to work out what words are going to come out of your mouth to respond? Is it the same process and the same voice that's going around your head when you're trying to put the words down to begin with?
I feel like I have someone else's voice in my head. It doesn't feel like the kind of like fleshing out thing. It's more like the characters just sort of circling around, and the way I'm saying it out loud is, yeah, them kind of being recited to, but it's also me kind of fixing this character down and making them feel more real. But yeah, it is kind of someone else.
And in the second book, second novel you're working on at the moment, is it also a very interior point of view that you're using? And is it someone who's, I mean, you might not want to talk about this right at the moment, is it someone that's a far more removed character from yourself? Because obviously if Little Scratch had it's fiction, but it the germ of it came from something in your lunch break.
It's still a very interior experience. It's slightly less formally claustrophobic or formally overwhelming, although it's formally weird, and it is very interior. I think that's really I do stray towards a very kind of personal, very immediate voice. It's again present tense, although there is some distance in by nature of the fact that I'm writing across more than just one day, and so the closeness of Little Scratch to time, you know, because I'm trying to kind of inhabit a whole day, there's an immediate kind of immediacy, there's an immediate closeness because you're trying to get as close as possible to zinging experience, going, whereas like this second novel, because it's across 5 days, it's going between kind of memories of her life and this one present tense thread that's happening, and so there's an immediate kind of distance, a kind of measuredness, or a kind of reflection, but it is still very immediate.
The voice, you sort of found it so readily there to occupy with how you're writing, and you knew the integrity of the thought and what you were saying in that voice. I guess when you come up to having 3 days where you're not working on that, does the voice disappear or does it pop up all the time? I mean, you're having your month off at the moment. Like, is that voice silent or do you find yourself, because it's so close to you, that you start reflecting on things happening in your life?
I think I'm able to keep this second person more at a distance than the first person. But I think that was also because, as you were saying, like, you know, Little Scratch is a novel, but I borrowed loads of like environments that I know. And so there was a kind of texture of a world. It was like putting someone else into a world that I knew. And so it was quite hard to distance myself from that voice, because even when I was paused from writing or like just not writing, I would be kind of seeing things that she might see or being thinking about something that she might be occupied with or whatever. And so I would often kind of accidentally slip into her voice. I would find myself kind of basically writing but by thinking, and so I'd be thinking in her voice and I'd be like, well, this would be helpful if I wasn't just like actually just trying to live my life. You're like, get out. You know, another reason to write that book very quickly, it was just like, please, can this very entertaining but quite full-on person escape from my head?
The difficulty with flushing a sort of voice out of your brain is just thinking about it, because it's probably one of those things that when you're not in the middle of a project, it doesn't seem so immediate to you, and such a strange thing that you have this completely alternative voice with an alternative reality in your mind. I mean, it does sound completely crazy probably to people who don't write or people who haven't really thought about it, but it's very true. It's fiction, and I appreciate that there's a very traumatic event that's dealt with in Little Scratch, but you because it's based in environments very similar to what you worked in, did you have to warn people in real life that it's not referring to anything?
It's not like a so exact portrait. Like, there are real differences to, and very intentional differences made so that it's not an exact mirror to a workplace or whatever that I know. But I also think that like those differences are kind of pointless to put in because people see what they want to see. And in the same way that the character's not me, but it's like a young first person female, so like obviously loads of people just think it's me. And it was kind of like, in a way, I mean, no, I didn't warn anyone. And I was kind of playing up to the inevitability that I was going to be confused with the character. And so for me, it was kind of just like, this is more funny to like insert kind of meta references, because it's just like, it's going to happen. So like, let's just bring the fight now. Yeah, like, I don't know. I kind of just think I have the right to write what I want. And particularly because it's not like I've, you know, taken someone's name and then made a character from them that's like evil or something. Like, I've written a novel about an assistant who works in a media company. Like, you know, that's a pretty general thing. And yeah, I kind of like, I made sure to not warn people or apologize or contextualize, because I kind of just think I don't need to do that. And loads of people write kind of veiled novels that are actually far more true to their life and to experiences and to digs at people. Like, those exist, and they exist without apology. So I kind of feel like, I can borrow any words that I want without having to say anything.
I mean, that's very true as well, isn't it? Thinking about it, it's fiction. And it's also much weirder if you went and told people in advance, oh yeah, just so you're aware, there's a bit.
It becomes an ordeal, becomes a thing. Like,
what are you saying?
Yeah, it makes it sound more like it is. Like, I think if I went round and was like, oh, hey, by the way, I've written this novel about an assistant.
It's definitely not about you.
Yeah. Then they're like, shit, it's about me, you know.
What an odd thing to have told me. Now I'm, like, yeah. Now I'm terrified. Yeah, I guess, but people are really obsessed with it, aren't they? This is something I've sort of thought and written about a bit, like the reality of fiction and stuff. People are really, really obsessed about what's true and what's not true. And I feel it's a pretty odd obsession, considering people don't generally go and watch a film and say, yeah, like, oh, is that true? There's something about the novel, isn't there?
I mean, I just think that people still are uncomfortable with the idea that they can read a book and it can feel real and it not be real. I think that is still a kind of like a collision that they can't quite get their head around. It's kind of like, it'd be more reassuring it's like the reader wants proof that the experience they've had, if it's like an emotional experience or a profound experience or whatever, they want proof that there's a kind of the authenticity that they feel like is for a reason. I think it's like, it's often a kind of compliment, but it's a very irritating compliment. And I don't know, like, I do understand the compulsion, and I think it does speak to getting close to a kind of reading experience that feels true. And I think that's fine. I think that people need to be like better educated and versed in the art of fiction writing, because I think there's just something about writing, because everyone writes, like, you know, you're writing an email, whatever, but everyone knows what it is to write. And the basis of writing generally in terms of like the literal putting words together is you forming an opinion or you writing something, even if it's kind of I'll see you at 12 o'clock looking forward to it. Like, that's still you in some ways trying to convey yourself. And so I think because like we're using the same tool, there is a kind of immediate confusion or overlap, and that's just kind of how it is.
Thank you to Rebecca for joining us, and thank you to you for listening.
I hope you enjoyed this episode. Do rate and like it wherever you find your podcast. You can find us online at unsoundmethods.co.uk and listen to our back catalogue of podcasts, or you can find us on Twitter at unsoundmethods. You can find me and my writing at lachlanbloom.com, or I'm on Twitter at lachlanbloom.
You can find out about me and my writing at Jamie Batchin on Twitter, at Jamie_Batchin on Instagram, and my website is jamiebatchin.com, all spelt the weird way of spelling Jamie. Rebecca also has a website and some social media stuff, so we'll put that in the show notes, which you will find below where you've been listening to this episode. Thank you for listening. Take care, and we'll talk to you next time.